Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 295, I chat with Don Eklund of Sony Corporation about UHD and high dynamic range. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 10th, 2016. Episode 295, Sony on UHD. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hi there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Don Eklund, Senior Vice President of New Format Promotion at Sony Corporation of America, and the fourth guest ever on Home Theater Geeks way back in January 2010. Don, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks. Great to talk to you, Scott.
And you. Now, before we get started, I want to make sure that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room from there, which goes to irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions for Don as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It helps if you put my screen name in the message, by the way, anywhere in the message, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen, and my eye will be drawn more readily to it. So, Don, you used to work for Sony Pictures, and then you went away for a while. Now you're back at Sony Corporation as the Senior Vice President of New Format Promotion. And of course, the big new format that everyone's talking about these days is Ultra HD, which includes high dynamic range and wide color gamut. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I appreciate you being here to talk about that, because you and I have had many discussions about it at trade shows and stuff and such. And it really is. Some people have said, oh, 4K, it's just the next 3D, or high dynamic range, oh, it's just the next 3D. But that really isn't true, is it?
No. I mean, I've seen you attend some of these conferences, Scott, so you know that it's a hot topic, and there's more than one dimension to doing it. Increasing frame rate, increasing color gamut, dynamic range resolution, it's all part of really a new opportunity for distributing content to consumers' homes. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting time right now. Things are changing quickly. I have to admit I've had certain prejudices about formats or distribution systems from experiences a couple of years ago, and really you have to reevaluate now. I mean, what didn't work then can give you a pretty good experience now. Like, for instance,
for example, over the top. Can you give us some examples of what you mean by that?
Yeah. So, I've been always a little bit of a snob about package media. I think, having high bit rate delivery, and a good lean back experience is important. And, years ago, if you were subscribing to over the top services, usually you were getting a pretty low bit rate stream. And the compression artifacts just drive me nuts. So and the fact that, sometimes you hit like buffering, or you hit various things that interrupt the experience and take you out of the story. I hate that. But I've been experimenting with some of the services now from, for instance, Amazon now is offering UHD, some titles with HDR. There's probably three or four services out there right now that are offering a UHD resolution. And I have to say they're pretty good. Some of them are using, significantly higher bit rates than they used to use.
And, which, of course, it requires, though, that the consumer have that much bandwidth coming into their home.
Yeah. If you've got a decent ISP, I think most people can access, 20 or 30 megabits per second now. Because I experiment, I've got a much higher connection, and I can't really take advantage of that. But if I'm not mistaken, I think Amazon's at about 15 megabits per second, and they're doing a pretty good job at that data rate. I've also talked to them about where that's going, and where other services are going. And my understanding is that the rates are even going to go higher, and that they're going to give UHD Blu-ray a decent run for the money by, you know, maybe this time next year.
Mm, well, that should be interesting. Loquacious in the chat room is saying, I've heard it said, don't bother yet because there isn't very much content. And I suppose compared to, you know, HD content, that's probably still true, but it's coming along nicely, I think, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, now we're in second generation sets, right? Like you could, I think it was reasonable in 2014 or 2015 to say, you know, the market's developing. There's not a lot of content out there. But the floodgates are starting to open because now you've got all the major studios releasing UHD Blu-ray discs. You've got UHD players in the market. Some other services that are a little more esoteric, like Kaleidoscape, that have the ability to deliver it, you know, to their own high-end boxes. So mm-hmm. I think the water's pretty good, and it's not so bad to jump in now. I've been experimenting with a set that I borrowed, and you know, I've had a lot of fun with it, with looking at some of these services and discs, and experimenting with some photographs.
Oh yeah, photography is another really good application. You sent me a couple of graphics that I'd love to show here. First of all, we have sort of the adoption rate of 4K TVs in the past and in the future. And in this graphic, well, tell us what we're looking at here.
Well, it's showing, you know, something that I think everyone realizes, that, you know, 4K sets are going to become a much larger part of the market. I don't know that everyone is buying 4K sets because they are looking for exclusively or as much 4K content as they can get. I think part of it is the fact that 4K sets are the premium sets now.
Yeah, you know, you can't buy a premium set that isn't 4K or Ultra HD, to be more precise.
That's right. And they're already very economical. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me, Scott. We used to talk about it with HD and with Blu-ray, the fact that, you know, the large HD screens got, you know, really inexpensive. The players weren't very expensive. And now it's all repeating itself with HDR and you know, Quad HD. It's amazing how much you can buy for a dollar now in display technology.
Yeah, yeah. The other factor that's so important, I think, here, particularly with regard to resolution, is the fact that the screen size is increasing. And we have a little graphic to show that in different parts of the world, showing that every 2 years, as this graph shows, you know, more and more people are buying larger and larger screen sizes, which makes a lot of sense because you need that larger screen size in order to have the full benefit of the increased resolution.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a double-edged sword because, you know, when you bring home a 75-inch or 65-inch set and you're sitting two or three screen heights away from it, you know, you might have been able to ignore poor compression, you know, in the past where, you know, the screen was larger and you were five or six screen heights away from it. But even people who, you know, don't consider themselves videophiles or, you know, they're just casual you know, users, if you've got a live sporting event or something that is, you know, got a lot of compression artifacts and the screen's big, they're just, you know, they're as big as a grapefruit. You can't miss them. So, yeah, I don't miss an opportunity to pressure my friends in the cable and satellite business to say, hey, when can I have the super premium high bit rate transmission in UHD? I think there's a market for that.
Yeah, I would agree. The other graphic that I have to show that I'd love to show here is you sent me a list sort of all the different sources that are now available, which is the point you were making a few minutes ago, which is graphic number 3 there, Josh. which should have a list of all the different ways that people can now get UHD content. And this addresses Loquacious's point, which we can see here. We've got all kinds of different. We got UHD Blu-ray, of course. We've got streaming services. You mentioned Kaleidoscape as a 4K video server. There are others. Dune HD 4K is one. Even Sony. Sony was the first one to make the FMP X1 and then now the FMP X10, which I don't remember. Does that do HDR?
Those boxes are not 10-bit boxes, if I recall correctly. So I don't believe that those will do HDR.
Well, I think the Kaleidoscape will when it ships. I don't know if it's actually shipped yet. And I don't know if the Dune will either. I'll have to look into that. But those are all, you know, several different examples of streaming boxes to which you download content rather than streaming it live from the internet. You download it into these boxes and then it'll play at whatever the, you know, whatever bit rate it needs to get a really super great image. By the way, that reminds me, Free Wi-Fi on the, in the chat room is asking, what's the bit rate on UHD Blu-ray? It's a lot faster than regular Blu-ray, right?
Well, it's got a couple advantages. So first of all, it's still variable rate. But if I'm not mistaken, the peak bit rate can go as high as 100 megabits per second.
That's what I recall, too.
For a short period of time. Mm-hmm. So, and we've got...
Whereas regular Blu-ray is less than half that.
That's right. Yeah, that's for regular Blu-ray's 48 megabits per second overall. So as a practical matter, the video rate's limited to about 40 megabits per second.
Right, right, exactly. So we and the Ultra HD Blu-ray, of course, has a lot more capacity on it as well. 100 gigabytes
or 160. Yeah, 66 is standard. That's dual layer. 100 is triple layer. And it's got a different compression scheme. So you'll hear different numbers about how much more efficient HEVC is than H.264 or ABC. But, you know, 2-to-1 is probably optimistic, but it's definitely better. So it's not just a matter of having twice the bit rate. It's having, you know, let's say for arguments, twice the efficiency. So and 10 bits. I mean, you know... Even if you're not a big fan of, let's say, high dynamic range, you think that, you know, I don't really need, you know, super bright picture or, you know, all of the whiz-bang highlights and so on. Having 10-bit, that's a big deal, you know, for consumers to be able to get 10-bit content. Because we used to struggle with that, you know, when we were making Blu-rays. And even to this day, you know, you've got a beautiful sunrise or sunset, and, you know, there's no getting around that banding. You know,
that's
you
right.
You can try to dither and do some tricks, but, you know, 8 bits is a real limitation.
I have to agree. I was watching a documentary not long ago on my 8-bit projector, and it was underwater stuff. And underwater is a really great test for banding, because the gradations are so gradual that that's very often you can see the banding. Sunsets are another issue. Let's see. I had a question here. Where was it? I'll look on it. Oh, yeah. What about data caps? PC Guy 8088 says, problem here in Canada is many providers have data caps. And if you're streaming a 4K UHD content, especially with high dynamic range, 10-bit, you're going to run into that data cap really fast, huh?
Yeah, UHD Blu-ray is your friend.
Yes, it is. I agree. And because, you know, no data caps. And again, I've said this many times, and you said it here already a few minutes ago, you know, how UHD Blu-ray in general, physical media is going to give you a better quality picture, just hands down, which some people say actually argue. A lot of people are saying, oh, physical media is dead. It's on its way out. Everything's going to go streaming and online. But with 4K and data caps and higher compression, more compression artifacts, might argue for that bringing back physical media?
Hey, well, vinyl's coming back, Scott.
Well, that's another topic altogether.
Yeah, I mean, in all seriousness, it really is. First of all, it's a very reliable experience. I mean, the disc works. You know, the fast forward, the rewind, the step forward backs works. You know, you can flip on subtitles if you missed a line. There's just a lot of advantages to package media. And, you know, Blu-ray has been the gold standard for high definition. UHD Blu-ray is going to be the gold standard for quad HD and high dynamic range. I really have no doubt about it. I watched a couple of titles recently and, you know, I just couldn't help but get a big grin because they looked amazing. And I'm a tough customer. I mean, there are titles out there that are less great in terms of how they translate into UHD resolution or how much HDR qualities they have or how wide the color gamut is. But, you know, there's some real jewels out there. So I think it's going to be fun to, you know, see people get excited again about package media.
Now, you're exactly right. And you also make a very good point about how the quality of what's out there so far, and there's only like, what, a dozen titles or so out there. We're expecting to see over 100 by the end of the year, but the initial rollout's been 12 or 15 titles, something like that, including some from Sony, Fox, Warner Brothers, and Lionsgate, I believe, are the four. But the early reports indicate that the HDR quality in particular is kind of spotty. It's inconsistent, shall we say.
Yeah.
And we're in the very early days of this, so I suspect part of the problem might be, well, mastering engineers are this is new. This is something brand new, and they're getting used to what they can do with it and so on. And it kind of reminds me of the early days of multi-channel music recordings. The very early ones, you know, had, I remember hearing a demo with the Eagles and the cowbell was clanking at me strictly from the left or the right surround. And nowadays, of course, if you buy multi-channel music, which still isn't all that popular, but it does exist, and what you get of it, it sounds really good. So people learned how to do it better. And I think maybe the same thing's happening here. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's an interesting point you raise because it affects not just the, you know, the distribution format or the monitors. It affects the way films get made and edited. So, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. If you can,
very good.
You know, if you can do an edit and go from a dark scene that somebody's been watching for 5 minutes and take them into broad daylight, it's just kind of like, you know, when you open your front door and you've, you know, been in a dark room, it kind of hurts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it needs to be used judiciously, but, you know, you don't want to take people out of the story, right? I mean, films are about telling stories. It's a little different than live sports, which, you know, maybe we could touch on for a moment too. But, you know, even if there's only a few seconds in a motion picture that really benefits from, you know, pushing, you know, peak luminance on your set, let's say there's fireworks or gunshots or a battle scene or something, you know, it helps to tell the story. You don't need to hit you in the face all the time.
Yeah. Now, I'm happy to say that from all the reports I've read, Sony Pictures has done some of the best work on the initial Ultra HD Blu-ray titles. So I wouldn't say that if I didn't think it was true or hadn't read it elsewhere. I only got the Samsung player a couple days ago, and I haven't yet hooked it up, so I need to get some titles and start looking at things. But that's what I've read. And in particular, the kind of the funny thing is, almost everybody acknowledges one of the very best examples of high dynamic range Ultra HD Blu-ray is from Sony. It's Smurfs 2.
Yep. It's true.
And I'm going, okay, well, that's great. I'm glad there's a really good example of it, but Smurfs 2?
Yeah, it's great because it's got, you know, those deep saturated colors, and it does use the high dynamic range really well. I mean, it's an animated feature after all. So, you know, I think you can take liberties. Pixar has given some presentations talking about the making of Inside Out. And they also said that, you know, they sort of took liberties to to drive emotion when, you know, the guy was losing his temper, and they would, you know, crank up the, you know, the peak luminance on the torch coming out of his head and so on, you know,
right.
to their advantage. But there's some other titles too. I just watched last weekend, I watched Concussion, and that title, that's one of the titles I was mentioning, really put a smile on my face. It was just amazing. And you know, it wasn't shot with the top end Sony camera. I'm kind of sorry to say that. But regardless of it, of that, you know, the way the cinematographer used the close-ups and, you know, he didn't intentionally blur or underexpose any of the shots. It just, it's one of those reference titles that, you know, you can really see your system shine if everything's working right.
Mm. Besides which, it's a great movie. I actually missed it in the theater. My wife went and saw it. It actually isn't a really loud movie. And she thought it was fantastic, a phenomenal movie as movies go. So this brings up another point that I wanted to ask you about, which is, so let's contrast the Concussion, which is critically acclaimed, really important movie, and Smurfs 2. How is it, there's the picture of the cover art for Smurfs 2. How is it that studios, and I know you can only speak really about Sony, select which movies are going to come out initially here in this first batch, because in many cases, you know, some of them aren't necessarily the, you know, the best movies as movies go, but they're chosen. I mean, you Sony has a ton of legacy material that could easily be classics that could be made into Ultra HD Blu-rays, and I'm sure they will eventually. But I'm really interested in the question of how do you choose which movies are going to come out at first?
Yeah, well, with, I'm going to beg forgiveness and say, you know, I don't work in the part of the studio that makes those decisions.
Understood.
I think some of the titles, you know, make a lot of sense. Other titles, I mean, they want to appeal to, you know, the consumer that's going to buy these state-of-the-art products. And so I think that's driven some of the choices. But I think all the studios are working through their catalogs to see what really works in HDR. You know, you might love a film, but it doesn't necessarily translate well into a high dynamic range or even, you know, UHD, it doesn't cause a problem, but HDR can cause a problem. Mm. In that if you've got something that was really, let's say, for even for creative reasons, underexposed, very grainy, you know, the shots were, you know, the film was edited in such a way that there's a lot of dramatic shifts in light, it just may not, you know, be ideal. It doesn't mean that they won't release it eventually, but not necessarily a title that you'd want to lead with because customers might get the wrong impression.
Ah, right. If it doesn't show off the technology well, then yeah, you're right. And obviously, apparently, the Smurfs 2 does. It shows off the technology super well. and Concussion then will be another one. And we have a couple other. We have a Chappie is another one.
Chappie's also great. Yeah,
it looks really good, huh?
Yeah, it's outstanding. You know, the one thing, if you're trying to impress your friends, then a title that's shot digital is likely, you know, with a digital cinema camera is likely to be more of a sure thing for high dynamic range.
Mm.
With film titles, some of those look very good too, including the Sony titles. But, you know, it's with the understanding that there's going to be film grain and that, you know, film grain with higher dynamic range means more film grain. So, you know,
you're going to see it more. As you said, with a 4K TV, you know, you're going to see more of whatever's there, artifacts, film grain, whatever.
That's right. And if it's a large format negative, then, you know, that's probably no problem. With a conventional negative, you know, cinema has never been, you know, 1,000 or 4,000 nits. It's been
not by far
something that you watched in a you know, dark movie theater or on, let's say, 100 or 200 nit consumer display. So this is sort of uncharted territory. And it's really also in some ways similar to what we experienced with Blu-ray when we started launching high definition titles. And we were seeing things on these display on the consumer displays because they were, you know, set to 300 or 400 nits peak white, and it was lifting a lot of information that was in the blacks. It wasn't that the sets had poor black performance; they were just revealing things that nobody thought you were really supposed to be able to see down there.
Mm.
And in some ways, that changed the way, you know, color grading and QC was done, you know, years ago when we started releasing high definition. I think there'll be probably a similar process for high dynamic range where you've got to go through that extra care to make sure something's not revealed that you didn't really intend.
Yet another thing for the mastering engineer to keep in mind, and more money for the studios to spend. This is always the big problem, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a good time to be a color grading engineer because they're certainly needed for this craft.
Mm-hmm.
Colorists,
yes, exactly.
Right. Colorists.
User 6099, whose name he tells me is Hamid, how will audio be packed into UHD Blu-ray? Is Atmos going to be its own thing, or is it going to start part of True HD? What about DTS? So what's your sense of how the audio is going to shake out on UHD Blu-ray? Some of these titles are probably Atmos, right?
You know, I have to confess, Scott, I'm not expert on how they're putting Atmos soundtracks onto UHD Blu-ray. I'm almost certain that it's been provided for by packing the audio in a specific fashion to make it decodable as Atmos. Mm-hmm. But I haven't played with it. And I hate to talk about it if I haven't actually experimented
Understood.
With it. All
Understood.
The other options are there as far as high bit rate DTS and high bit rate Dolby or LPCM. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's certainly not going to have any shortcomings in terms of audio delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a strong response from your viewers or from your blogs about people that are really anxious to get Atmos into their homes?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag, I'll tell you the truth. There are plenty of people now who have Atmos in their homes and others who who aren't interested in it. So there's a wide range of attitudes towards Atmos. And so, you know, those who have it really like it. I'm a big fan of it. But there are those who say, I don't want to put more speakers in my room, and 5.1 or 7.1 is plenty fine enough for me. So, you know, you got the whole range there. Another related question back to video, though, is high dynamic range. As we know, there's more than one format for it. There's the open standard HDR10, which is basically a SMPTE kind of an open standard, which I think Sony uses on its titles. And then there's also Dolby Vision, yet another Dolby technology, which is we see in commercial cinema now. And we were talking about that before the show started. And I think Sony titles don't yet use Dolby Vision. And I wonder if you have any information or can share any information about what you're using now is HDR10. I'm almost certain, right?
So HDR10, that term actually was coined out of the Blu-ray Disc Association.
Oh, really? I didn't know where it came from. I knew it was kind of, it was not a technical official term, but more sort of slang, I guess.
It is, but it's a term everybody seems to understand now. You know, it's a little bit of a long conversation explaining the different transfer functions and why they're important. But you're right, there are more than one option out there. Broadcasters in particular have been looking at a couple of possible options. One's called HLG. The other is SMPTE 2084. The old term for that, informal term for that, was PQ. And the consumer sets can potentially do either one. Both of them can give you a high-quality, high-dynamic range picture. Where they differ is in terms of where their extremes are. SMPTE 2084 is designed to specify signals up to the brightest thing that you would ever have in your home, about 10,000 nits. HLG is less than that. Exactly.
I thought HLG was relative. What we have now for EOTF, or electro-optical transfer function, which is the thing that determines how the display, how much light the display puts out, given a code value for how much brightness is in the picture, in the signal, PQ or SMPTE 2084, which Dolby Vision also uses, is referenced to an absolute value, 10,000 nits. I thought HLG, hybrid log gamma, is what that stands for, was relative. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. There's a sort of a de facto standard that will probably come in terms of what HLG is targeting, where its sweet spot is, put it that mm-hmm. way, of something north of 1,000 nits. But the difference is that SMPTE 2084 is prescriptive in terms of not just that the peak is at 10,000, but that every code value represents a certain light output from the screen. And that has certain advantages, and it can have some disadvantages. So that's what the cable and the satellite and the broadcast industry are actually all very actively discussing right now is, how do we generate high dynamic range suitable content from cameras? How do we get it all the way through the production plant? And how do we simultaneously make standard dynamic range versions of the same content for customers? What are the most effective ways of doing that? You asked an earlier question too. So Sony is releasing some content in Dolby Vision for over-the-top services. Netflix and Vudu are both supporting Dolby Vision, and Sony mm-hmm. Pictures is releasing that. The Sony displays don't support Dolby Vision. That's something they haven't chosen to do at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's currently laid out. The Blu-ray players have options to support Dolby Vision and to support other transfer function mechanisms.
Right.
But the current discs that are out at the moment, to my knowledge, they all are based on ST2084 HDR10.
Yep, I agree. And the only player on the market currently, which is the Samsung UBD K8500, does not support Dolby Vision. It's not required that it do, and it didn't. They decided not to.
That's right. So
I got a couple questions here in the chat room, but before we get to those, and they're related to what we were just talking about, but before we get there, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Epson. Now, Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative, refillable ink tank. It comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages, equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors and laser-quality black text. Plus, auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. It's no wonder that the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's epson.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Epson, exceed your vision. So I'm talking with Don Eklund, Senior Vice President of New Format Promotion at Sony Corporate. And Free Wi-Fi has a question here that relates to what we were just talking about. Will an HDR movie look the same on a 1,000... 5,000 and or 10,000 nit display. We don't have a 10,000 nit display yet, but as we were talking about earlier, SMPTE 2084 is sort of pegged to a maximum brightness of 10,000 nits. Will the top end be different, or will the scene fill the entire dynamic range of the specified display?
So that's a great question. And it really depends on the master, the disc that you play, as to whether you're going to see a difference, or the over-the-top content. So as we were talking about a moment ago, ST2084 is prescriptive in that if you code a pixel with a certain value, the display is supposed to do its best to reproduce that specific light level. Now, I think most filmmakers would say, you know, they're not going to code things to be very bright all the time. And in fact, just because a set is specified to have 1,000 or 5,000 nits peak white doesn't mean that the whole screen will do that. You can only drive a portion of the screen to be that bright.
Very good point.
But you can have instances where, you know, something's got like fireworks and they're very bright. And on a 1,000 nit set, they're going to look great. And on a 5,000 nit set, they're going to look even better and more realistic and spectacular because that set's got the headroom to do it. But you can think of it almost like hi-fi, where, you know, not every track needs, you know, tremendous dynamic range, but some of them do. And when you've got the power and, or in this case, the peak white to support that, you know, you might be able to appreciate it. Most of the time, if you put a 1,000 nit and a 5,000 nit set side by side, I would say most of the content that you're watching, if you could feed the same signal to both monitors, they're going to look very similar. You know, up until you get to those really extreme areas. And those are not, you know, frequent necessarily. You know, there may be 2,000 or 3,000 nit coded values in some masters, but, you know, they're in the places that you'd expect, right? So daylight, sparkly things, or chrome,
sun reflecting off chrome, that kind of thing. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, we don't even have, I mean, even mastering displays, I mean, the highest I've ever heard of is the Dolby mastering display, which gets to, I think, 4,000 nits. And otherwise, you know, I think most mastering houses are probably using 1,000 nit mastering display. That's what I've heard anyway, right?
Yeah, the Sony, the BVMX300 is a Sony professional OLED, and that peaks at right around 1,000 nits.
I've seen that thing, and it is awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's a spectacular set. And the other thing too, for the person that asked the question, that's important, is that a 1,000 nit set doesn't just clip when it gets something that is, you know, beyond its capability.
A picture that's coded for 2,000 nits, say, one particular spot.
Right. So they've got a kind of a roll-off function. We typically refer to it as a tone map, so that you don't get a hard clip, or, you know, again, just to draw on the audio analogy, it's not like you've, you know, suddenly run out of gas and you're just getting horrible distortion. It's it's a gentle roll-off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know.
We should talk about color space.
Please.
We've got a moment, because I've noticed in recent conversation that that seems to create a lot of confusion. You've probably heard, Scott, that UHD Blu-ray and the UHD standards support 2020 color.
Mm-hmm.
And the confusion comes from the idea that all of the new sets are reproducing 2020 color. What they're doing is they accept a 2020 signal. You can think of 2020 as a signal space or a container.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to the way digital cinema works, but the color primaries are the native primaries of the sets can be anywhere between, you know, something beyond Rec 709, at least probably P3, out to something in between there and 2020. So 2020 has very extreme color primaries. What the manufacturers are doing, and what the studios are doing, is releasing content targeting reproducing P3. So they, you know, this is a convenient thing that's emerged out of digital cinema, that It's certainly a wider space than Rec 709. The reds are deeper, can reproduce greens that you can't see in 709. It's a noticeably improved color space, but it's not 2020 color. It's P3 color that's been mapped into 2020 containers. Mm. So I think, you know, there may be a new set of distribution primaries that are used at some point in the future that are wider than P3. It's technically possible with laser light engines or with certain technologies, quantum dots and other proprietary technologies to go broader than P3. Mm-hmm. But that's where we are at the moment. So I just thought I'd try to clarify that for those that are saying, hey, I've got 2020 primaries in my display.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. It doesn't exist except in laser projectors, basically.
That's right. So,
exactly. And it could potentially be in quantum dot LCD displays as well. And just unfortunately, I don't have the graphic to show the difference between 2020 P3 and 709. But we're really talking about a range of colors, and the current HD standard is a certain range of colors. Digital cinema is a wider range of colors. You can see more, it can reproduce more colors than HD 709 can. And 2020 is bigger still. But there are no consumer displays that can do 2020. Although I did want to bring up an interesting point here. You mentioned Inside Out earlier, which is an animated feature. And it was mastered and shown, graded at with P3 color. Except one scene. Did you know this? The one scene where Joy and Sadness, I think, are in the deep, dark recesses of Riley's subconscious, and her greatest fear is of this clown, right? Do you remember that scene?
I do.
That scene in Dolby Vision, in a Dolby Cinema, had 2020 color. Because the Dolby Vision projectors are laser-based projectors. They can actually reach 2020. And the people who made that movie took that one scene, just that one scene, and actually expanded it out to 2020 in order to make it more impactful, because you're in the scary part of the movie and you're in the deep, dark subconscious fears of the protagonist there. And, you know, I didn't notice it at the time, but I learned about it later, and then I realized, you know, the colors in that one scene were different. They were more saturated still. Did you know that?
I might have heard something about it. I have heard them speak about the title a couple of times. But unfortunately, I didn't get to see it in Dolby Laser Theater. So I didn't get the benefit of that.
Well, it was interesting. Again, I didn't think to myself at the time, wait a second, those colors aren't P3. I was too engaged in the movie. I mean, that's a great movie. But later I was told that, and by some of the people who worked on the movie, and I went, oh, that's why it looked different. I remembered it sort of looked a little different. So I thought that was kind of neat. Speaking of projectors, Emily the Strange is asking, do you think 4K UHD would be diminished using it on a projector? And really, I think what we're talking about here probably is with HDR, high dynamic range. Because other than Sony, nobody else makes true 4K home projectors.
So projectors just don't go to the same extremes of contrast that that flat panel displays do. That's been true even in current cinema and the current sets that you can buy now. So they don't reproduce the same impression in terms of contrast. But, Sony, as an example, has an extraordinary projector. It's also expensive, but it's amazing in terms of resolution and dynamic range. So,
you're talking about the VW5000?
The 5000, yeah. That projector, I think will rival the kind of experience that you can get in a Dolby theater with their laser projection. Mm-hmm. And you can get it in your home, but it is different. You're not going to get that stunning highlight that you would get on a, for instance, a a Sony Backlight Master Drive set, you know, when we get something in the future that, you know, can go to extraordinary peak white levels.
That'll go to 4,000 nits. At least that's what I learned at CES this year.
The
prototype demo for it. It went to 4,000.
Yeah, it was. That was amazing to me. I saw that set not long before CES, and what was amazing was not that you know, there was a bright set, but the fact that it had been packaged in the format of a regular consumer set and wasn't drawing extraordinary amounts of power. And in fact, it was, you know, the same power draw as a conventional 85-inch set, and yet it was producing, you know, 4,000 nits peak white. That was, I didn't think we'd see that for years.
And yet here it is. And it was in prototype form, of course, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was more product-like, you know, in a year or so. I mean, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. You're from Sony. I'm not. But it looked like it was farther along than I would have expected, just as you said.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's see. There was another question here. Oh, Charlie X, and this brings up a point I wanted to mention as well. Charlie X is surprised that Sony has not developed its own proprietary HDR format. Now, Sony actually on its TVs has come up with a logo called 4K HDR. So in that sense, I guess Sony has decided to brand or market or identify its high dynamic range sets in a particular way that's different from, say, you Ultra HD Premium or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, Sony's got its own intentions in terms of how they market products to consumer, what they think makes sense. I'm not sure that UHDA Premium necessarily screams, you know, ultra high definition or high dynamic range to consumers. But, you know, as far as proprietary formats go, we were talking earlier about transfer functions, and that's that's an important aspect of what makes these things possible. You know, we're sort of at the intersection now of new compression standards, new display technology, the implementation of these transfer functions, and all of that has to coalesce in order to be able to deliver HDR to a customer. So it's possible you could, you know, go your own way. Our professional cameras, for instance, use transfer functions that, you know, are suitable for cameras and for, you know, professional content creation. But as a practical matter, you know, doing anything proprietary these days and making it a mass market product is challenging.
Very challenging. McButterpants in the chat room asks, so with TVs becoming so good, will there be any benefit to going out to the movies, out to the theater in the future?
Well, you could probably answer that question as well as I could, Scott. I think, you know, there's just no substitute for the experience of going into a big auditorium and, you know, sitting down in front of a giant screen. You know, it's a group experience, and it's, you know, you're going out to see something first run. I think it's still going to be some time before you're going to be able to get,
Oh, look, it's a kitty.
Yeah. He's demanding. So, yes. It's going to be a while before you're going to be able to get first run films, in your home day and date with theatrical release. You know, the theatrical exhibition business has something to say about that.
Yeah. Unless you're in Bel Air and you're a member of this, I forget what the name of the club is. There's, you know, you can spend $25,000 and get a day and date release in your home for another $500, and you've got to have a Prima Cinema. You know, it's basically a little commercial cinema in your home, but that's for the 0.001%.
Right. Yeah. That's just a cinema server, and you know, they're basically setting you up to be a small exhibitor at that point.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to make sure we get to this, live broadcast, HDR in particular. And this has its own set of challenges. We've been talking so far mostly about Ultra HD Blu-ray or streaming, downloading, which the studios can take all the time they want to prepare, to grade and master and get it just right and ship it off, and there you go. Live broadcasting, like sports, as you mentioned earlier, is a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
It is. You know, that's a complicated industry. It takes a lot of cameras, a lot of people to bring you, you know, these huge live productions. I can't remember the. I think it was something north of 150 cameras that they used for the Super Bowl. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
But the thing about live content and HDR that I think is a wonderful combination is that, you know, live sports, you can watch almost any live sporting event and you can see that it actually suffers from a lack of dynamic range. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the crowd's in the sun or the players are in the sun and the crowd's in the dark, or, you know, there's always something that's overexposed or underexposed necessarily because, you know, these things are shot out in daylight and they don't have control like they do on a movie set. To bring you a, you know, an optimized, you know, exposed image. I also think it just adds a lot of excitement when you can reproduce something that just is so incredibly realistic with a high frame rate, high dynamic range. I think that's going to be, you know, just so compelling for big sports fans. And I think that's going to give them, you know, the ammunition they need to convince, you know, their significant other that, hey, we're not taking vacation. We have to have this new set because the football game just looked so incredible at the bar when I saw this in high dynamic range, or Joe down the street's got it. And it's kind of a sea change, really. You know, the fact that, you know, there are the videophile, you know, community out there who will buy these high-end sets, that, you know, now are becoming really, they're still high end, but they're much more affordable. And, you know, we buy movies, we search for high quality content experiences. But we all settle for kind of a rubbish experience when it comes to live sports. I mean, there's a lot of compression. You know, there's the, you know, these standard dynamic range problems. I think people are just going to be blown away, Scott, when they see what these sets can do when you put live images into them. And I say that with a little bit of experience playing with, you know, shooting some content and playing with even still images. I mean, your audience can use digital photos that they shot raw 10 years ago and put those images up on these screens and see things that they never knew they had, because you've never really had, you know, displays, whether it was a computer display, consumer display, display of any kind, that could really show you what's already in the record that you have in these photographs.
Mm. You know, that brings up an interesting point. We talk a lot about high dynamic range on AVS Forum, of course, and I and many others post pictures to sort of illustrate things, but mostly what people are seeing on their computer monitors isn't high dynamic range. So it's a pretty poor representation or illustration of that. But yep, maybe that will change. Did you go to the HPA tech retreat last month?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, so you were there. I had my show a couple weeks ago was a panel of some people who were there, including Mike Heiss, who I'm sure you know, who talked about when they're shooting high dynamic range live for live broadcast sports in particular, as we've been talking about, they actually sit in the truck and do more grading toward standard dynamic range,
right?
Letting the high dynamic range kind of take care of itself. That seems like an interesting approach. I hadn't thought of that before Mike brought it up.
Yeah, but it makes perfect sense when you think about it, because you know, you don't have to take so much care for the high dynamic range image to get the picture across, because you've just got more latitude. It's figuring out what to squeeze down, if you're going to lift the blacks or squeeze down, you know, something that's in the sunlight, in order to make sure that, you know, the audience can follow the game, you know, because, you know, they've got an iris, obviously. But, you know, the way they adjust the cameras, you know, in the truck, or, you know, the camera operator in some instances, they're just trying to make sure that you're getting what's important out of the game.
Right.
And, you know, so it is, it's a interesting situation, you know, for these traditional production crews to figure out, okay, wait, how are we going to protect for making sure that, you know, we get a great HDR experience, but we also can, you know, basically color grade on the fly to make an SDR version, or, you know, can we use semi-automated tools to help, you know, make that easier? Mm-hmm. And there has been some good work that's been done to show how to cope with that. And I think that's an area that's ripe for lots of development, for being able to you know, produce HDR, but get high quality SDR simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. I imagine we'll see a lot of tools and techniques and so on to do that at the NAB show coming up in April.
That's right. That's going to be another HDR fest at NAB, I'm sure.
And I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But the broadcast industry, they're really in a difficult spot right now. Just grappling with all of the other changes that they've got going on with the spectrum auction that you may have heard about. Mm-hmm. You know, when they were making the transition from traditional analog broadcast to ATSC 1.0, they could have adjacent channels, full bandwidth channels, in order to simulcast for years both programs. That's not the case now with ATSC 1.0 and 3.0. So it's going to be interesting to see how they cope with that. I'm wondering if they're also going to be resorting to deliver, you know, premium experiences to customers over the top while they continue with ATSC 1.0 broadcast for some time. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
It is going to be an interesting thing to watch. Just another point on this topic. I just got an email today that said that DirecTV was going to broadcast the Masters Golf Tournament on April 7th on their new 4K channel. Now, I don't know. They've launched a dedicated 4K satellite or satellite to and handle their 4K content. And this will be like the first thing that comes out on it. I don't know if it'll be high dynamic range or not, but it will be, you know, in Ultra HD. And then a week or so ago, I got a note, an email about something about how the Olympics in Rio this year are going to be broadcast. Well, sort of. They're going to be, some of it's going to be recorded in 8K by Japan, by NHK, beamed over to Japan. And that's going to get down converted to 4K. We're not going to see any of that in the US, unfortunately. But the broadcast of Ultra HD of, you know, whether you call it 4K or even 8K, which is technically under the UHD umbrella, it's now just about upon us.
That's right. Yeah. The Korean market is also trying to prepare for the 2018 Olympics in Seoul, right?
Right.
And so they have really had their eye on the ball with ATSC 3.0, which, coincidentally, you know, Korea is one of the markets that uses the ATSC standards for broadcast. So that's going to be interesting to see how that rolls out. They've got more flexibility than American broadcasters do in some respects.
How's that?
I think in terms of RF spectrum. And
I see.
So, you know, they have the flexibility to make a smoother transition potentially to ATSC 3.0. And that's 2018. I mean, 2018 is going to be here before you know it. So, you know, pretty exciting times for people that are going to be able to watch that live broadcast. And, you know, hopefully us in the States will also have mechanisms for, you know, distributing those games in real time, and we'll be able to watch them. I know I'm going to be looking for that.
Yeah, me too. In the couple minutes we have left, I'd love for you to address this question. It seems to me and a lot of people that there's a lot about high dynamic range that is now fairly well defined in terms of the EOTF, although that's, you know, there's a couple of choices there. There's PQ and there's HLG and a few other parameters, but there are also some things that aren't yet perfectly well defined. How do you see that moving forward? I mean, are we going to be waiting yet for yet another year or two before everything's really locked down?
Can you give me an example, Scott, of what you mean in terms of something that you think is not well-defined around HDR?
Well, like, for example, peak luminance can be, you know, one set might have this, one other, another set might have that. We have room to grow in the future because PQ is pegged to 10,000 nits, which we're not going to see for some number of years. But I guess that's, so it's not well-defined in that sense. Another big question for me is when a TV says that it can reproduce 90% of P3, the Ultra HD premium spec, for example, says the TV must be able to reproduce more than 90% of P3. But what does that mean, 90% of a triangle on the CIE diagram? I mean, it could mean a variety of things. Is there any way to make that more specific, or is that just going to be the way it is?
Well, you know, we were talking about the sets having different native primaries.
Yes.
If those don't line up exactly with P3, then they may, you know, be offset a little bit in one color or another. And that's why they've got
in one direction or another.
Yeah, that's right. But I think as a practical matter, they're actually doing a good job. They're probably tighter than that in most instances. Mm. You know, that's a tolerance. So I don't think, you know, the standards for P3 primaries is really at issue. I think you're right in that the creative community has to figure out what they want to do with HDR. Mm. You know, for, you know, sports broadcasting, production networks, concerts and so on, it's a no-brainer. I mean, it makes life easier in terms of transmitting something that takes you into that place. But with film production, you know, we've seen examples, you've probably seen them too, where there's a scene that when you reproduce it as an HDR master, suddenly it actually, you know, you're looking at the lights trailing across the ceiling instead of watching the performance of the actor because, you know, something caught your attention.
Mm.
So, you know, that's an area where, you know, we need to figure it out on the creative side, you know, how to really leverage, you know, what HDR can do. Everyone understands that wide gamut will help. 10 bits certainly helps, higher resolution, but when and how to use, you know, high dynamic range and peak luminance is something that I think is still, you know, going to be worked out, and it'll vary on a title by title basis.
Mm-hmm. Here's another example. Ultra HD premium certification has a very pretty specific, list of criteria. Sony has 4K HDR, which I honestly don't know what that means in terms of the very specific characteristics. But those are two examples of different badges, shall we say, even though we may not need no stinking badges. then there are the other TVs that are out there that say, yes, we're HDR, but we don't quite meet the UHD premium specification or something. So, again, from the consumer point of view, there seems to be some fluidity, some variation in what that exactly means.
Yeah. Well, you know, for device makers, set makers that haven't necessarily had good discipline in, you know, how they reproduce pictures in years past, I think the UHDA specification is useful in saying, hey, you know, this is what we expect if you're going to produce a high quality UHD experience, you should be able to meet these criteria. I do think that other manufacturers, you know, like Sony, who've been doing this for a long time and make both professional, you know, displays and consumer displays, we pretty much know how to make a color accurate picture. So, you know, just because you don't have a logo doesn't mean that you're not making you know, a good experience or the correct pictures. And I think, you know, consumers are going to, you know, notice that right away when they go to the showroom or they go to their friend's house and say, hey, you know, that looks like I could reach my hand into it. That just, you know,
Yeah.
It's real beyond belief. It's funny when I've had a couple of friends over and I've shown them some of these images on a 2015 display. They don't comment about how bright it is or, you know, how sharp it is. They just say, it just looks so incredibly real. Like I could just reach out and touch it. Mm-hmm. It gives a depth that, just doesn't exist when you flip to SDR, the image just looks flat.
Yeah.
People can start comparing against reality and, and you know, everybody knows what reality looks like. So you look at these screens and you think, oh my gosh, look at what they're accomplishing.
Do you remember when HD first came out and everybody said, it's like looking out a window? And now with HDR, it really is like looking out a window.
Yeah, that's right. I think there've actually been some people joke around where they've replaced windows with with flat panels.
Right, right.
Suspension of disbelief. I think the tools are there to really, suspend disbelief.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm a big advocate of HDR. Everything I've seen of it is, as you have said, phenomenal, just beautiful, like you can reach in. It's so much more like looking out a window than HD. And we are kind of in the super early stages of things. So as many people have said, it's kind of the Wild West in this realm right now. And the next year or two is just going to be fascinating. And I know you're going to be watching it as closely as I am. And maybe you'll come back in a year or so and we'll compare notes again. What do you say?
I'd love to do that, Scott. It's a great time to be a consumer.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for being here. That's Don Eklund, Senior Vice President of New Format Promotions at Sony Corporation. Don, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Scott.
You can find much more about Sony at sony.com, of course. You can find me at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Bob Schuline and Dan Mapes-Riordan, who just recently posted or created some new high-res audio files that the aim of which is to test the subjective improvement that high-res audio offers to consumers. So we're going to be talking about that and should be really, really interesting. I hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.